Brewers Publications, also known as BP, is the largest publisher of contemporary brewing literature for today's craft brewers, home brewers, and beer enthusiasts. With over 50 titles to choose from, there's a beer book to fill most needs. Whether you're just discovering beer or are a seasoned professional, BP is the go-to choice for brewers looking to expand their knowledge and hone their craft. Check out the complete BP catalog at brewerspublications.com. Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, February 2nd, 2017. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, homebrewer Ryan Deaver talks to us from the country of Benin in Africa about palm wine, a spontaneously fermented beverage made from the sap of palm trees. If you're new to homebrewing or would like to get into the hobby for the first time, check out our website, basicbrewing.com, where you can find archives of our audio and video podcasts and our DVDs to walk you through basic and more advanced brewing techniques. And if you buy any of our DVD combos, you get a free basic brewing bottle opener. Don't forget to get a copy of our Brewer's Logbook. You can use it to log and track up to 50 batches of beer. You can find me on Twitter. My username is Basic Brewing, all one word. We have a Basic Brewing Radio and Basic Brewing Video page on Facebook at facebook.com/basicbrewing. Thanks to everybody. Click on the Amazon.com associate link on our basicbrewing.com site. Whenever you think of Amazon shopping, think of us first. Go to basicbrewing.com, click on the ad on the right-hand side of the page. It won't cost you any extra, and you'll be helping us to bring you this show, and greatly appreciate your support. We also have associate links for Brew Your Own Magazine and the American Homebrewers Association on our site as well. You can find our Basic Brewing iPhone app on iTunes or Android app on Amazon.com. We have a Windows phone app. We're on the BlackBerry podcast directory. We're on the Stitcher app as well, Google Play Music, iHeartRadio. We're just everywhere. If you want to put a tip in our tip jar, some coinage in our virtual guitar case, you can go to basicbrewing.com/support. And thanks to everybody who's done so already. I'm finally getting around to sending out the prizes for our most recent Brewing Disaster Show. And thanks to the generosity of our disaster show sponsor, the folks at Brewhauler, everybody whose letter I read on the show gets a prize. Brewhauler sent carboy carriers for everybody, along with a pint glass and can koozies with the Brewhauler logo on them. Very cool and generous of the Brewhauler folks to send so much stuff. We appreciate that a lot. And everybody I've notified has been very happy that they're getting a prize, especially something as useful as a Brewhauler carboy carrier. And there are three brewers whom I haven't heard back from, and my email is probably in their spam mailbox. So if I read your letter on the show and you haven't seen an email from me asking for your mailing address, let me know. Specifically, I'm calling out to you, Mark from London, Kevin from Ohio, and Jerry from Oregon. And let me know, and I'll get you your Brewhauler in the mail. And thanks again to the folks at Brewhauler for being our disaster show sponsor once again this past year. Let's take a very quick look into the mailbag. Since our guest is from the continent of Africa, let's hear from Curtis in Johannesburg, South Africa. Curtis says, recently listened to your episode on cream ales. I was a bit behind and thought I'd share another suggestion with you. Toward the end of last year, I brewed a cream ale based on the recipe you shared. But for a bit of change, I dry-hopped with some Amarillo. The result was really good. The Amarillo paired really well with the Sots, and everyone seemed to enjoy the beer since the bottles didn't even last a weekend. Curtis says it might upset the purists, but I thought it was an interesting version of a solid beer. I'm planning to experiment with some more dry-hop variations, and we'll let you know how those go. Well, that sounds delicious, Curtis. If there are any cream ale purists that would be offended, I'll take their share. I like that cream ale recipe, and dry hopping with Amarillo sounds like the perfect combination. Next week on the program, I'm going to be chatting with Ricky the Mead Maker from Groenfell Meadery in Vermont and Havoc Meadery. I don't normally forward promote shows, but I do want to let you know that Ricky has put all of the recipes for Groenfell and Havoc Meads out on their website. So go look at those. If you're a mead maker, if you're looking for recipe ideas, if you want to know how Ricky makes those delicious meads that we tasted on the show, go to groenfell.com/recipes. That's groenfell.com/recipes. And Ricky is going to talk about mead making best practices with us next week. Because a lot of times mead recipes are just simple. You know, it's just like water, honey, and yeast. But it's what you do with those that makes delicious mead. Now let's talk about our sponsors, Desiree and Dave from High Gravity in Tulsa, with the story about brewing with Steve Wilkes. Steve, as you know, is the owner of Steve's Brew Shop in Fayetteville, Arkansas. And Steve's taking part in a collaborative brew with local home brewers, where a bunch of them are getting together and brewing batches of Russian Imperial Stout to put into a 55-gallon bourbon barrel. And since it was such a big beer, more than 20 pounds of grain for a 5-gallon batch, I volunteered the use of my electric brew-in-a-bag high-gravity system with the Warthog controller, because it's got the big 62-quart kettle and 4,500 watts of power. Well, Steve got to the house, my house, with his grain, but he forgot his hops and yeast. So I already had the strike water all warmed up, so we started the mash, doughed in, and boy, there's a lot of grain, and drove back to his shop in Fayetteville, which is like a 30-minute trip to get there. But it was great leaving the high-gravity system alone, knowing that the Warthog controller would take care of holding the mash at temperature while we were gone. And it did. When we got back, everything was great. And when it came to time to boil, it was easy to boil away, you know, 4 gallons of water to reach our desired starting gravity, even on a windy day. And hard to do with my old propane setup. Needless to say, I'm still very happy with my electric brewing system from High Gravity in Tulsa. Check them out. They have a wide range of turnkey systems and standalone controllers to fit many, many needs. So you can find all of them on highgravitybrew.com. Now, every now and then I come upon a topic that's a little off the usual path, but I think we can learn from hearing about different brewing practices and maybe find something that fits into ours. There's a lot of talk nowadays about spontaneous fermentation, and Ryan Deaver is a spontaneous fermentation enthusiast from Missouri. So he was excited to see the process of making palm wine in the West African country of Benin. Well, Ryan Deaver, welcome to Basic Brewing Radio.
Thank you.
You're the first interview that I've done with someone who is on the continent of Africa. So we're breaking new ground here today.
That's great. Yeah, I'm glad to be here.
Now, first of all, let's get some background on you and talk a bit about your educational background and talk about your background in being a home brewer.
Sure. So I guess growing up, I was always, strangely enough, really interested in mushrooms. I grew up in a really small farming community in rural Missouri, and every year, you know, folks would go mushroom hunting right around turkey season, and I got really into it. I got really into mushroom hunting from the time I was a little kid, and didn't necessarily see that as a career prospect, but I went to college, thought that I was going to study religion, did for a while, but I guess I took some chemistry and some biology as prerequisites, got really into it, and I studied biochemistry and molecular biology, and it sort of clicked that I might be able to study mycology or the science of fungi in general. So I did that. I then went on to grad school and did my master's in biology as well, with an emphasis in the ecology and evolution of fungi. But that wasn't just filamentous fungi like your conventional molds and mushrooms. It was also yeast, which when I discovered craft beer, I was obviously fascinated by the microbiology of beer. It was just a pretty obvious connection, I guess. And so I had all this laboratory experience and immediately started developing ways to do that at home, which I had a lot of questions. you know, how can I prepare media at home in the same fashion as I might in the laboratory? How can I maintain cultures? And so that naturally led me to some communities of brewers like Milk the Funk on Facebook. Dan Pixley is a great guy over there. And so I guess I got introduced to a community of people who brew sour beers and conduct mixed fermentations and spontaneous fermentations. And so that's sort of where I was at before I took the job and came here to Benin, West Africa.
So you've jumped in deep, as they say, into home brewing with some specific knowledge.
Yeah, and I think that it really lent itself well. I feel like I was able to overcome some of the hurdles that a lot of folks struggle with early on, like sanitation, like getting your pitching rates correct, choosing strains, understanding that there are really some fundamental differences in the metabolism of, you know, different generant species and strains. So I don't know. I think the microbiology part of it is, I mean, they do most of the work, you know, yeast make beer and we make the wort. So it's.
Yeah. Yeah. They are very helpful little critters. So were you able to successfully harvest some rural Missouri bugs to ferment beer?
Oh, of course. So, it's funny you should ask. I have, I was really sad in a way coming here because I had to leave all my home brewing at home in the States. I knew I wasn't going to make any beer. There certainly isn't any barley here. There is, but it belongs to the big macro breweries here that make a bunch of really bad adjunct lagers. And so I made some preparations. I brewed a couple of what I would call pseudolambics. I don't really intend to blend them or anything, but they're just straight lambics, just a Belgian golden ale base. But I did make a little cool ship, and I harvested some bugs late last fall, and I pitched those into a beer. And it was starting to come along really nicely when I left, so it's going to sit in the cellar for the 2 years that I'm over here. And hopefully when I get back, it will be good.
Well, that's one way to keep out of the beer is go halfway around the world.
Go to Africa.
So talk about where you are and what you're doing and how you got there.
Well, I'm in Benin, which I think usually when people hear that, and when I heard it, when I got offered the job, my first question was, where is Benin? So if you're familiar at all with the geography of West Africa, it's right between Togo and Nigeria, just under Niger. It's a pretty small country, and it's one of the most underdeveloped and poor countries on the planet. And I work with an organization back in the States that has placed me here to do development work, specifically in the domain of the environment and food production, food security particularly. There's also a big thrust on educating women and children to create really just to push them towards getting good educations and developing skills that they can actually use to generate income for themselves. And as far as how I got here, yeah, it's that's a great question. That's a big question. I guess I was staring down the barrel of taking a job as a microbiologist at a bioethanol fermentation plant, actually. And I had submitted this application a year in advance, and right as I was about to take this job as a microbiologist, I got this call, and I thought, you know what, I'm going to do it. So.
Well, you sound young, and you've got the rest of your life to work at a fuel plant.
Exactly.
Well, good for you. It sounds like you're doing some good work. So what about the culture of Benin? What's it like?
So I had some folks try to explain it to me before I came here, and I got to say, I don't think they did it any justice. People talk about culture shock, you know, and when I got here, it was jarring. People are, first of all, very kind here. People are extremely hospitable. My first week at my site where I work, a woman who sells beans for a living invited me to her house for Christmas, and I'd never met this woman before, and so I went to her house on Christmas, and she made me a full meal, gave me Coca-Cola, which is very, very expensive here. We watched movies together, and that's just across the board. Folks are really generous like that. It's strange in a way, the juxtaposition of pretty abject poverty, I guess, and just how happy folks here seem to be. I mean, people here realize that the quality of life is low, the life expectancy is low, there's a lot of illness, there are a lot of problems here. But also, people here seem to be just as happy, if not happier, than folks that I know in the States. And they do just about the same things. You know, they have kids, they love their kids, they go to work, normal people stuff. So
I guess it gives you some perspective. You know, there is probably... you know, there are probably several different kinds of quote unquote poverty, you know, and you can have enough money and still be poor in other ways.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of things that we can learn and that I'm learning right now from these folks. And there's just a tremendous emphasis on community here. The government, and this is a story across the board in a lot of countries in Africa, is, for lack of a better word, there's a lot of corruption. There's a lot of very detrimental corruption. It makes it difficult to do development work here because people line their pockets and there's not a lot of infrastructure. But what I do see here is in almost every community, even rural, small communities, there's almost always an NGO, there's almost always an organization run by someone from Benin, from the community, who has left, got an education, and come back to continue development work in the community themselves, because you can't sit around and wait for the government to help you. And it's really impressive. So,
well, it's cool to get some background on where you are. But we are a program about fermented beverages here. talk about how you first discovered palm wine. You sort of went on an adventure.
Yeah, it was very much an adventure, and I didn't really know what was going to happen, which is kind of the story across the board here. It was really weird. I knew that folks here made spontaneously fermented beverages because, hey, everybody everywhere makes alcohol somehow, and I just didn't know what it would look like or where I'd find it. But within my first week or two here, I was staying with a host family, and I went to church with my host brother, this young man that I was living with. I guess, I mean, he was 17 years old, but I guess sometimes he subbed in as the preacher to this little rural church. I mean, it was a shack out in the country, basically. So we went, and I don't know. After that, he took me on a motorcycle ride, and I didn't know where we were going. And we ended up at his uncle's house. And it turns out, halfway through our visit there, he turns to me and he says, "You know, my uncle makes palm wine. Are you interested in this?" And of course, my eyes just light up. Of course, I'm interested in this. This is what I love this stuff, you know? And it was just this moment where it clicked that I was sort of uniquely positioned to ask some really cool questions. That it tickled my fancy anyway. So I got to hang out with this guy who makes palm wine in part for a living. And he showed me his whole process, and we talked pretty much all day about it.
So what part of the, or is it the dates? Is it what part of the palm gets fermented?
Right. This is a great question. I wasn't really sure, you know. And then so the first thing he showed me, we went behind his house, and he takes me to this clearing in the woods, and there's a palm tree cut down, and I think, okay, that's weird. But underneath the palm tree, he's dug a trench, and in the trench there is a plastic oil jug. So it was like a previously used to hold motor oil that he'd cleaned out and stuck underneath this log. And on the top of the log, he peels back the bark, and he has carved a hole that's the approximate dimensions of a shoebox. And the hole stops right at the pulpy base of the tree. So there's this big taproot. He cuts into the taproot, but at the top of the root, there's this big pulpy mass that just is leaking very slowly. This it looks like foam, but the foam sort of slowly drags its way across the inside of the tree and drips down to the jug, and that's how he collects the sap, and that's what he ferments.
So what, do you have any idea what the sugar content of the sap is? Is it like, you know, maple is, you know, very low in sugar. They have to boil the sugar for a long, or the sap for a long time to get the, you know, maple syrup. Do you have any idea of what the, you know, the specific gravity or the bricks of palm juice is?
So it's really funny you should ask that. That was my first question. And of course, I didn't come here with any kind of analytical equipment, but I did have my family send me a refractometer. And there's a guy in my community who makes palm wine. So at the earliest opportunity, when I get back, I'm going to go see this guy and take a quick sample to see what the original gravity is. I can tell you that when it finishes out, it's not particularly dry. I asked somebody what the distilled spirit, so they make a liquor. That's primarily what people use the palm wine for. Some people really just like drinking the palm wine for parties in particular, but most of it is for moonshine. And somebody, and I don't know about the accuracy of this, but he said it was ballpark 60%.
Wow.
When it's all said and done.
Well, when you're distilling, yeah, that's, you get you can get a lot of alcohol fairly quickly that way.
Yeah.
So did you taste?
I had to look at my notes as far as. Yeah.
Were you able to taste the sap yourself, the raw product?
Yeah, and that was really interesting. I got to taste the raw product and then also some of the finished product when it was still pretty young, and also when it was pretty, when it was finished, when it was ready to be distilled. And it tasted a lot like coconut water. You've ever had coconut water, but very sweet. It's really sweet.
Oh, well, that there is, you know, your tongue is a pretty good analytical instrument there. So I'd say that, yeah. You know, it's got probably more sugar, or a lot more sugar than, you know, say maple sap.
Yeah.
So if they're chopping down the trees to get the juice to make the palm wine, you know, just from hearing that, it doesn't sound very sustainable. You know, how many trees have to die for, you know, for a jug of palm wine, and or can, you know, can one felled tree make a lot of it?
So I've thought a lot about this. I've talked a lot about this with folks. I was curious, same thing. And I think there are a couple of considerations. One is that some people wait until the tree is past its prime. And when I say past its prime, I mean that the tree is not just used to make booze. It's an introduced species, so this is not a palm tree that's native to Benin. But there's a lot of it. People really went wild planting it, and they still do. And it's really sort of utilitarian because people use the nuts of the tree as food. They press it for cooking oil. They use it for all kinds of building applications. They use it to build fences for their gardens, which there are goats and children everywhere here, and it's an absolute necessity. They make brooms, they make soap, they make everything out of these trees. So really, it's sort of a political thing, who can cut down which trees and why. If you own a big plot of land, you can do whatever you want with your trees. Doesn't matter if it's sustainable, I mean, at least to the individual. There are some people here who have entire plantations of palm trees that they just mow down and make palm wine, and when it's finished they just plant and wait, and that's it. But for most people, like the man I was talking with, it's supplemental income. He has to buy the trees from his landlord, and so he has to be really deliberate about which trees he chooses, because he can cut down a bigger tree, but if the tree is really big, it's going to take a lot of work, and it takes more time, and it's, you know, it's hard work. Or he could buy two smaller trees and take a gamble and maybe not get as much juice. So it's, I don't know, it's a little complicated.
The economics
the
of palm wine.
Exactly. But I think he said, it really just depends on how long you want to wait, because one tree will continue to produce juice for a month, give or take, once you've cut it down. You can get, he said, anywhere between 5 to 10 liters per day, but he has to fill a 250-liter drum for a full fermentation to produce a quantity of liquor, ultimately, that he can sell and to turn a profit. So it's
wow. That's a lot. That's a lot of juice.
It's a lot of juice.
So where does the process, once you gather the palm juice, what's the next step?
So he physically carries these jugs. He goes and checks on his jugs every day, a couple times a day, and he carries them back to his house up the hill, and he just dumps them straight into a big plastic rain barrel. And I imagine that at this point, they've been inoculated with microbes from both contacting the wood and also from bugs. There are a lot of bugs that end up in this stuff. And I imagine that the bugs are a really good source of yeast and bacteria. But also, I imagine he's got some microbial flora hanging out in these big plastic oil drums because they're scratched up, they're old. And he just dumps the juice in there and just waits. That's it. Once he's got a full batch, he says he waits anywhere between a month to a month and a half. It's done when it's done, which I think we can all relate to. He even has a blow-off valve that he improvises. It's just a length of copper tube that he electrical tapes or glues into an opening that he bores into the top of the drum. And it's attached to his house. It's not hooked up to any kind of sanitizer solution or anything like that. It just blows through a big copper coil and comes out the other end. So
if he's done the previous fermentations in these barrels, there's probably a good colony of microbes in there from the previous fermentations, I would assume.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of like barrel aging, but on a pretty short scale.
So what's the, I mean, do they take gravity readings? I mean, you know, we can look at a hydrometer reading or a refractometer reading and kind of get an idea of when our beers are finished. But do they have, you know, any kind of, formal analytical equipment that they use to gauge, you know, whether this stuff has finished?
Taste and activity. So if you look in there, it doesn't look like there's any activity. If it tastes drier, it's been a month and a half, it's finished. But no, nothing that I saw in the way of analytical techniques. And you have to remember, this is just one guy. He's been doing it his whole life, but this is just one guy's approach. I'm sure that there are some folks that have various methods for deciding when things are finished.
And I guess since you don't know the starting gravity, you probably, or do you have an idea of what the alcohol content of the finished product is?
I can tell you that when I tried it, I had a bowl of it, whatever that means, just like a big metal bowl that was given to me. And I was feeling a little tipsy afterwards, so I couldn't tell you as far as alcohol content. I'm a little sad about that. I think once I have a specific gravity, or rather an original gravity reading, I can tell you a little more. But I think I mean, I've asked some local people, and people have told me, oh, it's 12%, oh, it's 6%, it's 4%. People drink the wine, not the liquor, but the wine itself when it's still pretty young, and I've heard 4%, 6%. When it's like half fermented. So,
and what's the flavor profile? What's it taste like?
phenolic, but in a very good way, in a way that's really reminiscent of some Belgian saison yeasts. I get sort of it's a little funky, and it's got a honey sweetness to it that I get from some wild Saccharomyces that I've harvested before. So I imagine that that's probably where that's coming from, some wild sac. But also, it's got a really neat lactic acid character that it's curious because, you know, in a lot of mixed fermentations that I've got experience with, that lactic character doesn't develop until later on, especially in lambics, you know, when you pitch all the bugs all at once or you pitch bugs after the Saccharomyces is finished. It can take months, years to develop that character. But when you've got this lag period, when the Saccharomyces is probably still in really small quantities, these other microbes can do their work and contribute this flavor profile really early on, I guess. I mean, that's the only thing I can imagine. So it's neat. It's got this sort of Belgian phenolic vibe, but also a lactic acid character that kind of lingers at the end. So it's good. It's really good.
I imagine if people are making this in different regions or different areas, you could kind of get a terroir, of different flavors in different places.
Oh, no doubt.
Is there a benefit to drinking it young? I mean, does it go, quote unquote, bad over time? Do the, you know, to do some of those bad flavors come out over time?
Well, something I was wondering, but it sounds like nobody ages this stuff long enough to experience some of the nastier flavor contributions. They drink it pretty green, and when it's finished, they use it to make liquor. And so, as far as a shelf life for this stuff goes, I don't think people really know. I'm sure somebody's left a jug sitting around for a while, but I wouldn't know about it. So,
There are no vertical tastings of the palm wine.
yeah.
So how, I mean, we don't talk about distilling usually here on this show, but talk
Sure.
about the distillation process.
It's fascinating. We went. I mean, it was a still. That's really all there is to it. This guy had a clay oven that he'd built, and he just loaded it down with charcoal and made a wood fire. And he placed a really probably a 50-gallon metal drum onto the top of the clay oven, and had cut a section out of the drum that he was able to replace and fasten down with some, I guess, with clamps. And basically what they did was they carried these plastic jugs. They racked the finished palm wine out of the 250-liter drum back into the oil drums and carried it in individually, basically in 10 to 25-liter quantities at a time, just through the bush, basically, to this guy's house, dumped it all into a communal pot, and built the fire underneath of it, and then it went through three condensers, which were just barrels full of really dirty water, and a copper coil. So,
And what did it taste like afterwards?
I try not to endorse drinking moonshine, because nobody wants to drink wood alcohol, but I would be lying if I said I wasn't curious and if I didn't taste it. It's got a weird mycological kind of thing going on. It's got a mushroomy, it's very distinctive. It's not altogether bad, but it's also not something I would seek out. So,
And would this be wood alcohol, or, I mean, it's coming out of wood.
no, I think as in any distillation, I think they knew what they were doing. They discarded the first runnings. They tasted it to see when the good stuff was flowing, and that's what they kept. So,
And that, people who know about distillation will recognize that I'm completely ignorant of that process. So,
oh, me too.
but are there any ill effects from drinking any of these products?
So I'm not sure about the truth behind this, but I have seen some folks, and pardon the imagery, but I was told that if you drink a lot of palm wine, and there are people here that do, namely palm wine producers, there are a lot of folks that make palm wine and they drink a lot of palm wine. And I was told that if you do that, if you partake all day, every day, your groin, your testicles will swell up abnormally, to the point of being like debilitating. You can't walk. And there are some folks in my community that actually have that problem. So,
Wow. That would be enough to keep me away from the palm wine, I would think, but
I mean, I had to try it.
a little dabble, do you, I guess.
Yeah, that was good enough for me.
So what, from a home brewer's perspective, what what can we learn from this process? I mean, you know, when you get back to the States or when you start brewing again, are there things that you've taken away from this process that you are going to implement into your own, you know, funky beers here at home?
Yeah, you know, I've been thinking a lot about this. I don't know that there are any grand revelations that I've had, but I think the biggest thing is seeing the process and then talking with some members of the sour beer brewing community. It really just drove home for me the difference between a spontaneous fermentation, a truly spontaneous fermentation, and trying to emulate a spontaneous fermentation with laboratory microbes, or even with pitching a mixed culture. Pitching cultures versus completely spontaneous fermentation, it's just frankly not the same thing. The order of operations really matters. And so I don't know that I'll have a ton of access to unfermented palm must or palm juice, but as far as process goes, yeah, I think that's the big takeaway for me, is just experimenting more with truly spontaneous fermentations or partially spontaneous fermentations, and giving it a chance. I think there's a stigma in the brewing community against really spontaneous fermentations from a health perspective, and I'm not sure how grounded that is. So,
yeah, I mean, there are things that aren't good for you out there that if you get the wrong thing in your spontaneous fermentation and you're not monitoring, you know, what's going on, you know, you could hurt yourself. But this practice, I would assume, has been going on for a long, long time. You're kind of taking a peek into the deep history of brewing in general, or fermentation in general.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's fascinating. And I was just blown away. And there are other beverages here as well that, I've got some friends that live in the northern part of the country, and they actually make spontaneously fermented beer with millet, with malted millet. And so I'm going to try to get up north and see that and try that as well. So there's a people here, are using, I guess, they're living in the same tradition. I don't know how else to say it.
And I wonder if there are similar products. I mean, if we can't get, you know, palm juice here in the United States or wherever people are listening, I wonder if there are similar products that, you know, could be fermented in a similar way. For instance, I went to this past fall, I went to a place where they were making sorghum, and, you know, taking sorghum cane, which is, you know, it's got a lot of sugar in it, you know, as opposed to maple sap, which they have to boil down, you know, it's a 40-to-1 ratio of sap versus syrup. The sorghum cane juice only had to, it's a 10-to-1 ratio. So there's a lot more sugar in that. So I'm just wondering, you know, and of course I didn't take a specific gravity reading of the raw sorghum cane juice, but I'm just wondering if it's, you know, similar in sugar content to the palm stuff.
Yeah, I don't know. But with respect to emulating this beverage or trying your hand at it yourself in the States or in more temperate regions in general, I've put some thought into this as well. I've done a little homework, and there are a lot of species of palm. There are a lot of trees that are in the same genus as the palm tree that exists here. And they're used pretty commonly as landscaping plants in the Southwest, in California, and Texas, and Florida. So they exist in North America. There are dozens of them. And I'm fairly certain that most any of them, with a little bit of experimentation, you know, you could... they're all going to leak sap. I don't know about the flavor profile or the sugar content of different species, but it's doable. You know, if you know somebody who has a landscaping company, or you want to talk to somebody about cutting down a palm tree, I think you could do it, and I think you could probably take a little bit of that sap and build it up into a culture. So, and then pitch that. You know, I think it's kind of the best of both worlds.
Yeah, that's true. You could just
forget the Saccharomyces. Yeah.
Yeah, you could use the sap as a starter for your beer and kind of have a hybrid thing there. But of course, I've got to say, from a legal disclaimer point of view, do your research on toxicology of these plants that you're Make sure 100%. They're not poisonous.
Yeah.
As you know, you're a fan of mushrooms. You know of the dangers of playing with stuff you don't know about.
Yep, you can try just once, as they say.
Well, this has been fascinating. Do you have any final thoughts before we let you get back to it?
I don't think I have anything too profound. I'm just having a really good time over here. We talked a little bit earlier. I'm on the mend from dysentery, so it's not all like super fun over here, and it is the developing world. Bad stuff, but I think I don't know. Maybe just that there are a lot of beautiful things over here too, and the culture surrounding palm wine is just this tiny microcosm of that culture, but it's a really integral part as well. It's just a real privilege to be over here and be able to see that and talk with these folks, because it's their livelihood, you know.
Sure. Well, speaking of privileges, it's been a privilege to talk to you, Ryan, and I appreciate your taking time out, and I hope you get all better soon, and thanks for taking time out to talk to us.
Yeah, it's thank you. Appreciate it.
Thanks again to Ryan. Very cool. People have been fermenting stuff for a long time, and if it has sugar in it, somebody somewhere has probably fermented it. I'll be interesting to hear if Ryan takes some of the practices he's learning in Benin and uses them in his own homebrew, and I hope he'll let us know when he does. In the meantime, if you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Check out our support link, where you can throw a couple of bucks into the tip jar by subscribing financially to our podcasts. Be sure to check out our DVDs, Extract Brewing and Partial Mashing, Stepping into All Grain, Low-Tech Lagering and Decoction Mashing, and Introduction to Wine Kits. You can find them all on our site. Get a free Basic Brewing bottle opener with any DVD combo, and you can check out our Basic Brewing shirts in the store as well. You can find our logbooks, where you can track and log up to 50 batches of beer. Check all of that good stuff out at basicbrewingshop.com. And thanks to everybody who's continued to click on our Amazon.com link. We appreciate the support there. Featured products this week that were purchased through the link are Brewing in Britain, An Illustrated History, and new solar eclipse glasses for safe, direct sun viewing. Very cool. Something coming up in August. I think it's August that you might need those. Thanks again, everybody. Remember, I can't tell who bought what, so no worries there. Just click on the Amazon.com logo on our site the next time you feel like Amazon shopping. We greatly appreciate your support. Don't forget, you can also join the American Homebrewers Association or subscribe to Brew Your Own magazine through the associate links on basicbrewing.com. That's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dodson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.